Okay, hello. It's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and it's a darn good thing because we have Dr. Tabrizian back, and he is here to talk to us about detoxification pathways in the liver and minerals. So, you know, the gut is always relevant. That's why we're in your large intestine, because it is always relevant. If I were coming to you from your inner ear canal, from your tear duct, from your left aorta, like, it just wouldn't be relevant every single time. But the intestine is. The gut is relevant always. Okay. So there's a few things about this particular episode. And one thing is that, let me see, I wrote them down. So I sent an email to Dr. Tabrizian after our last podcast that was one of the highest downloads in the first week that we've ever had. And I said, you know, invited him back and said that we would maybe talk about a few things. I said we can talk about estrogen detox, and he made some suggestions. I said, yeah, and definitely beta G, meaning beta glucuronidase. And he really thought that was funny and decided that it was like, we make some jokes about beta G's new album, and she's a rapper in Venice. Anyway, that's what the inside joke is, in case you're wondering what all the giggling is about. And then He also mentions some diagrams. You can hear him bringing up some diagrams. I attach those in the show notes. He's referencing some luteal phase and follicular phase diagram, and then a steroidal pathway diagram, and then a study that he talks about with estrogen being one of the regulators of energy production, which was super interesting. All of that is in the show notes. But if you are a Substack subscriber to my Stuff Your Doctor Should Know Substack, and you're a paid subscriber, you can see the video portion of this podcast, or the video version, and then you can see the diagrams when he holds them up. And it's also uncensored and unedited, that particular show. So another exciting reason to be a paid subscriber, which is only $8 a month. And guess what? If you become a founding member, which is $240 a year, you know what you get with that. You can post to me in the direct messages in Substack 2 times a year your Dutch results, and I can give you a review of your Dutch results. That's what's included in the founding member fee for my Substack. So nobody really knows that yet, but now you know. And of course, you also get all the other benefits that come with being a founding member. Those are listed when you subscribe, and including unedited, uncensored versions of my podcasts. He talks a lot about hair tissue mineral analysis in this. He's probably the most world-renowned doctor for hair tissue mineral analysis. There aren't many doctors who have done as much research and have actually used HTMAs in practical clinical settings as he has. So this is someone, if you're interested in HTMA, who you should listen to and hire even. He is so incredibly good with this. He knows so much. So you should check it out. That's also in the show notes. Let's see what else. Book. Oh, in the beginning, he's talking about sending me his book, but I think you'll figure that out. I think that's it. So I would definitely suggest listening to this a few times. We go off in different directions, and it's not quite as concise as the last one, but it's very informative, and you're going to love it. He's so funny, and he's so good at explaining things. So get out a piece of paper and a pencil and take some notes. Dr. Tabrizian.
So,
all right, well, before we get started, I've got a present for you.
Okay.
I found something that I want to post to you.
So amazing.
Let me know somehow where to send it.
Oh, wonderful. I'll send
Okay, so
you.
that was good. That was first order of business.
Thank you. Well, I hope you
I
signed
want to
it.
apologize for my bad accent for everyone in Laramie County and Fort Sanders.
I did get a few phone calls.
Oh, did you? That's terrible. He doesn't sound anything like Wyoming. He sounds more like he's from Cheyenne. I've made some notes so I don't get sidetracked or
So we don't get off
forget
into the
things.
weeds. I
Yeah.
had so many downloads already, and so many people reached out to me that absolutely loved the episode. Let's just start off by saying, just first of all, welcome back. But okay, there's a lot of people think, oh, gut health and hormones. That's a simple topic, but it's not, is it? Is there so many? It's robust. There's
It is.
so many things, like there's hormones. Well, hormones have processes that affect digestion, like cortisol,
Yeah.
like blood sugar
Yeah.
regulation. Like too much cortisol also can damage the gut. Then you've got the
Yeah.
opposite, where digestive processes affect hormones, and then you
Yeah.
have the detoxification processes that happen, and then you've got that
Yeah.
wild card of xenoestrogens. And then there's also hormones that have an impact on like smooth muscle of the gut, like progesterone. And I read that estrogen can play a role in influencing pain in the gut. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. So there's so many things that hormones and gut health we could talk about. So let's
Yeah.
comb through it from your perspective and talk about what you think comes to mind when
Sure.
I say gut health and
Well,
hormones.
look, it's a bit like methylation. The reason that we have so many pathways, and like if you just look at something like this, right? These hormones. Why are there so many arrows on these diagrams? And the reason is that it's such the really crucial factors have multiple backups, like a big city building, maybe a government federal building will have like the power supply protected, plus it'll have two essential supplies, and we're the same thing. So with methylation, you've got 13 ways or more that we know of to methylate something. In case 12 of them go down, you can still do it. And it's the same with these hormones. They have multiple tasks, so they're multitaskers. Now, I just want to make some corrections from last time. I kept using the word carcinogen with relationship to estradiol. I was interchanging the mitogen for carcinogen. So let's just say estradiol per se is not carcinogenic, but all things that mimic estradiol are carcinogenic, and the archetypal one is DDT. And I just want to say something about that because the general public thinks that it's a coincidence that DDT is estrogenic. It's not. The female of the species for insects are the breeders. Remember Alien? The big, yeah, get away from her, you bitch. And so it was no coincidence that DDT is estrogenic. It was deliberate to target the females of the insects, so, and many of the others that followed, estrogenic properties were deliberately built into those compounds. It is not an accident.
Okay, so you're not saying it was deliberately estrogenic for humans to have the impact, but for the mosquito or the bug to have to reduce
Exactly.
breeding. Okay.
So they deliberately created a carcinogenic xenoestrogen, and so it's maybe a little bit too easy to tar all the estrogens with that brush. So I just want to make that distinction between a mitogen, which stimulates cell division, and carcinogen, which is something that generates mutations. And the second thing about that is there are so many other things that are mitogenic as well. Sodium chloride, plain old table salt. If you have a petri dish of some whatever it is, growing in there, whether it be cell culture or bacterial culture, and you put a dash of sodium in there, you generate a mitogenic effect.
Wow.
So, yeah, I know. That term mitogen is very broad, the same as, things that are estrogenic. So I just wanted to clarify that. So, but all the metabolites of the estrogen have the propensity to be carcinogenic. And all the metabolites, or some of the metabolites of estrogen, are actually more estrogenic than the original product. And
They get
I'll
more
come to this a
potent.
bit. Yeah,
Is that right?
because, yeah, I'll get to this a bit later when we're talking about the degradation and metabolism of estrogens.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to just to clarify in case your readers didn't know was in Australia we call your thrift shops op shops. So when I was talking about op shops in terms of kidney function, where you take all everything down to your thrift shop and then you decide to take some things back, actually that model is the same with the estrogens. I thought that Beta G was a singer from Venice Beach, so I had to look her up. Happy birthday for Saturday, Becky G, by the way, if you're listening. So it's the same thing. You throw something away and then you change your mind. And the beta-glucuronidase system is very similar to the kidney in that you throw away things that you don't want and then you change your mind. But anyway, thrift shops is what I meant. And
Okay.
I must have cancer on the brain. I think it's talking about this subject because when I said that in the IVF series when they were using progestins to help pregnancies along, they got bladder cancers. It was actually bladder malformations, but I had that in my brain cancer, but it was malformations of the bladder.
Okay.
And that's what the light bulb came on. I go, oh, maybe we should be using what Mother Nature uses, which is bioidentical progesterone. So there was
Gotcha.
a pivotal moment there when they realized. The next correction I want to make is there are actually four estrogens. Just when you thought everything was nice and cozy in the triangle of
Triad.
estrogens, E1, there's E4. And that one is called estetrol. So tetrol as in tetra four and S as in estrogen. So estetrol. And that's made by the placenta. So it's for like local consumption. And there's probably reasons for it. And that is, it's a backup system so that even though estrogenic might be pro-inflammatory and in the womb you're exposed to the highest amount of estrogen ever in your life, there's something to mitigate that. So it might be what they call a partial agonist. So it protects you from very high levels of something. Herbs are like this. When they talk about adaptogenic herbs,
Yeah.
let's say you're talking about something like black cohosh, which can has a mild effect on estrogen receptors. So when the levels are low in the woman, the black cohosh mucks in and pretends to be estrogen, but if the levels are really high, it'll block the receptor. So that's what they call an adaptogen. So estetrol might be that. And it's what's interesting when you look it up on Wikipedia, it says that it's not fully certain what the function of estetrol is, but we're going to put it into a contraceptive.
Smart.
That's very typical in medicine. We don't know how it works, but we're just going to copy nature.
Right. That's what they did
Right.
with Premarin, right? Because there's so many other things besides estrogen and Premarin, and they're like, oh, it's probably good.
Yeah, if it's good for horses, it's good for us. If you've got an 800-kilogram horse and you put them on, and how did they get that big? And then you put that same thing into a tablet and you wonder why women gain weight. Maybe there's a connection there, maybe not.
Right.
It's coincidental, conspiracy. And the next thing I was talking about was I said that estradiol are pro-inflammatory, and the answer is yes and no. And when we come to later on about the Beta G and her latest album, I'll explain. Actually, there's a little bit more complication to that story in general, and it depends on who you read. And you know, so many of these things, if you stumble upon one line of literature, it'll seem to point you in a certain direction to say, oh yeah, estrogen is pro-inflammatory. But in fact, the complication of that is that it might be pro-inflammatory in one tissue, but anti-inflammatory in another. It depends on what that tissue is doing. So, and also when we do experiments, sometimes we just take one cell culture and put it in a petri dish and play around with it. Whereas that's a small part of a whole body thing. So, but I'll come back to that. So, not all estrogen is not always pro-inflammatory. And to be honest, even cytokines, you know, when people talk about interleukin 6, I don't know if you've come across cytokines in the big picture of COVID, for instance, like why people die of cytokine storm. Interleukin 6 is one of the things that you see really high in patients who are very sick with COVID. And it has all sorts of functions apart from, you know, revving up the immune system. But one of the things that it does is it's pro-arrhythmic, and it's one of the causes of death from arrhythmias in ICU. So, but that interleukin 6, if your girth is less than 100 cm, interleukin 6 is actually anti-inflammatory. If it's above a certain point, interleukin 6 changes tactic and becomes pro-inflammatory. So even there's no sort of set in stone rules for this because it depends on the context, you know. A bit like jokes, some people might find something offensive and some people will find it really, really funny. And I'm hoping you find it funny. And then the last thing I was saying, we're talking about copper, and it's sort of, see, the problem with copper is that we have almost an infinite tolerance for it. So we can store basically whatever comes in orally gets stored in the liver. And that's fine as long as you have a mechanism to get rid of the excess, because when copper gets past a certain point, it starts to steal exit pathways that the heavy metals use, and that's glutathione. So that only happens when it gets to this critical level in a person. So to protect those resources, we have a mechanism every morning, which is the peak in the hormone DHEA, which says to the liver, dump the extra copper so that we can at least, you know, have the same level tomorrow. So if you're not making enough DHEA, and that is an issue, you know, in a significant amount of the population, you can't dump the copper naturally. It just gets stored indefinitely and in infinite, you know, almost infinite amounts in the liver. So copper, it's not its fault. It's the mechanisms that would manage it. And to be fair, copper's trying to protect us, you know, especially in the as an anti-inflammatory. Well, there's two mechanisms why it's protective. One is you make the copper version of SOD, superoxide dismutase. And this is one of the reasons you see high coppers on hair samples, because there's an inflammatory process. And so you're making more enzymes to put the fire out. That's one of the things you see on hair samples. But also, copper is an antibiotic. So when you have an infection, the body hides the iron and raises the copper because the copper is likely to kill the bacteria that's trying to kill you. So it does have a protective effect, but it's at the mercy of, you know, the DHEA peak in the morning saying get rid of the extra copper, and then the other thing is the estrogen saying no, keep the copper. I told you to keep the copper. Who said to get rid of the copper? So there's these two opposing hormones, and copper's the rope in this tug of war. So, you know, all of our observations of high copper could be misconstrued. Like, you know, you could say, oh, well, it was just trying to protect me because I had a bacterial infection, or it was trying to mitigate heavy metals or reactive oxygen species by putting more fire extinguishers. So I just wanted to clarify some of those things, because some of the questions you got would have pertained to this type of thing, like, well, we were speaking of it in a very negative way, but it's Mother Nature generally doesn't put things in the body for some perfidious reasons. It is usually a good reason for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because you just answered a bunch of different questions in that, in those notes you had made. And when you brought up DHEA, one of our questions was about the role of DHEA, the longevity hormone. What's its role in managing copper in the liver? But he says, and this is Dr. Robert Selig, who I'm sure you know who he is. He's just a wonderful guy. He says, as I believe there has to be a hormonal signal that tells copper what to do. And we know DHEA has a gazillion jobs besides the hormonal stuff. So what is that hormonal signal? Is that something, is that just the natural rise of DHEA in the
Yeah,
morning or
it's the
specific?
circadian rhythm.
Okay.
Exactly, because the DHEA and melatonin cycle opposite each other to create the circadian rhythm. So, and the reason is that, well, there's lots of reasons, but if you take it on a purely pragmatic sort of thesis, so DHEA actually instructs the liver cells to allow outbound compounds that it wants to get rid of. So it could be copper, it could be mercury, it could be arsenic, that sort of thing. So it's a cathartic hormone, and this is one of the reasons why a lot of most people go to the have a number two in the morning. I don't know what the word is for in America for the polite word for stool, but
We use number two.
waiting to hear number two. Okay. So that's one of the reasons, because once it goes into the bile and into the gut, you want to evacuate it. You want to give it a one-way ticket to say, right, you're out. And so that mechanism it's on a timer, like a hose timer.
Rhythm, yeah.
But then at night time, when everything is quiet and all the creatures are still, you want to get the night fill guys. What do you call those people who at nighttime come out and refill the shelves in Safeway? And
Elves,
what stores do you have?
Oompa
Yeah, the night fill people. No,
Loompas.
Oompa Loompas are tiny. They can't reach the top shelves. You'd need an elevated work platform for Oompa Loompas to
Okay.
put the
Well, they're
Coca-Cola onto
magical,
the top
so
shelves. Oh, okay. All right. So maybe they've got their
Night
antiglaze stuff
Stalkers.
from Area 51. You know, they've got the antiglaze
Yeah.
shoes. So they all came from Nevada at some point. Anyway,
Nevada.
so
Okay.
Nevada, is it Nevada?
Nevada.
Carson City is the capital.
There
Got bigger.
we go.
There we go. So where
The night, so the
yeah, DHEA
night,
and
the Oompa Loompas
melatonin have
come in
this
at
opposite
night.
cycle. So
Okay.
what the night fill is, melatonin opens the inbound channels, and that's when you take up all your minerals at night. So,
Okay.
for instance, that's why they say take your calcium at night, because you've got a higher probability of it being actually absorbed into the cells. And so, if you measure the serum levels of the trace elements before bed and in the morning, they're always lower in the morning because the trace elements have been taken up under the influence of melatonin, apart from its other effects of, circadian rhythm, clock recycling. The antioxidant function to turn off pro-oxidant enzymes to tell the adrenal gland to go take a hike. Apart from all of those things, it's to uptake cells at night. So those two things, the cathartic hormone DHEA in the morning and the uptake or nutritive hormone melatonin, the night fill, Oompa Loompas, and that's how the body takes up nutrients and gets rid of toxins. So there's a cycle to it, a circadian
Wow.
rhythm to it, yeah.
Just digging into that more since this question is here, so, explaining how estrogens cause copper retention, and when copper is retained due to its ability to produce hydroxyl radicals, that can be so damaging to the liver. Can you get into that mechanism? Sounds like something.
Yeah. Okay. So for some time I was trying to figure out why the copper is in a copper level in a female is highest during pregnancy, for instance, and the estrogen is highest, because in cases of Wilson's disease, that is a really tricky time because they already have copper overload, and then the pregnancy increases the copper as well. So the tug of war is in favor for estrogens. Now, the reason for it is it actually comes 9 months later when the baby's born. Of all the things that the baby needs for survival, It actually, the breast milk has to be predominantly zinc. Okay, so if you compare breast milk levels of zinc and copper, the level of zinc in breast milk is roughly 8 to 10 times that of copper. So it's predominant, it's actually copper poor. Breast milk is copper poor. And the reason is that copper and zinc don't get on. If you have enough copper in the same meal, it blocks the zinc uptake. And we know this, all mammals are like this. This is a problem in sheep farming, cattle farming, and that's why they err on the side of not giving too much zinc on pastures and their supplements, because if they do have too much zinc, you get copper deficiency in the cows. And when that happens, the amount of milk they make drops per day. So if you do a blood test of milk production versus serum copper in a cow, it's a straight line. So the higher the copper, the more milk they make. So they're going to err on the side of having higher levels of copper because those mammals like it. And the same with sheep. If you're growing sheep for wool, and you put too much zinc on the soil, you're going to get copper deficiency, which means the wool breaks easily, which means they get less money for it. So a wool classer can tell if a sheep is copper deficient just from feeling their what's been
Wow.
shorn. So, but we're the opposite. We, as humans, we need the ratio the other way. We need lots of zinc, especially in the first 3 months of life, before the thymus gland kicks in and the pancreas kicks in. We've got to make sure that the and if you look at baby foods, you'll see this as well, higher levels of zinc than copper. So what you do is estrogen causes the liver to store extra copper for the time between birth and weaning. So the high level of estrogen cells, the baby's liver store more copper. Because you're going to get rid of it anyway. By 1 year of age, if you do biopsies of babies' livers and neonatal livers and human livers and work out their copper level, the baby is born with 10 times the copper level in parts per million to an adult
Wow.
because it's on a copper poor diet. It's on breast milk, which is predominantly zinc. And zinc is an antibiotic, it's a growth factor, it nurtures the emerging microbiome. It's important for the brain chemicals. So Mother Nature just said, look, I'll just give you ample amounts of copper until you're weaned, and I'll give you the zinc in your breast milk, and that'll be fine. And that's why, and that's in all mammals studied. So estrogens cause copper retention for a particular reason. But Mother Nature never extended women to go on the oral contraceptive for 10 years,
Right.
which is a very abnormally unphysiological situation, because then they're just going to store a whole lot of copper. And if you monitor copper levels over the menstrual cycle, you see that the copper peaks at ovulation and then it drops again, so that the baseline is the same as the start of the next month. So there's a clearance of copper, and it just follows estrogen levels like a puppy dog. Yeah.
Can you explain the anti-nutrient concept, especially with zinc, cadmium, and mercury, and how zinc is the
Yeah.
alkaline mineral because of its ability to synthesize carbonic acid? Please comb that out because none of that made sense to me.
Okay. So if you look at the periodic table, and it's got a bit like a castle turret. So you've got some on the left-hand side, the lighter elements, and then you've got this long strip in the middle. About half of the way, if you go past iron, cobalt, you'll get to copper. No, before copper, after cobalt is nickel, then zinc.
I'm looking
So
on the chart.
those trace elements in that group have, they're there for a reason. There's a sort of a big picture reason, like cosmological, and then there's kind of the human and life factor reason. So, and then when you go down, you've got zinc, and this is called the zinc series. That's what the scientists call it. Zinc, then cadmium, then mercury. So what it means is that because they have such similar structures when the cell sees them, there's no distinction between them. So if a cell sees cadmium, it thinks it's zinc, because it's in previous evolutionary life, the cell never had to distinguish between cadmium and zinc. And it's not since industrialization, but I'll make an exception to that with paleo, Neanderthal areas that were coastal later on. So zinc, cadmium, and mercury were never meant to mix. It's only since industrialization does the body then have this problem of cadmium and zinc, cadmium, mercury, and zinc, and like who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. So then if cadmium comes along, it will just follow wherever zinc goes. If mercury comes along, it'll follow wherever zinc goes because they don't have a role in the body. They're just going to sit in zinc's parking spot. So that's where you get the interactions of these things. So the anti-nutrient part is there's two bits there. One cadmium atom will block the equivalent of 10 zinc atoms, and one mercury atom will block the equivalent of 1,000 zinc atoms where it sits in the cell. So that means that if you have those metals coming in your body in situ, you need a higher level of zinc and zinc intake to counteract that problem. Yeah, so the zinc, so zinc, cadmium, and mercury. So for instance, with amalgam fillings, the issue was that when you bite on a filling, there's a shear force that releases the mercury as a gas, and you inhale that gas, and it goes through the lung, through the heart, and out through the body. And some estimates show that it's about 140 micrograms per day per tooth that this happens. So that was going to the tissues preferentially because there was heaps of empty parking spots. And the more empty parking spots, the higher the storage of these heavy metals like mercury. And we were talking about dentists last time and how they reckon the amalgam fillings are perfect and never caused any problems over 130 years. Well, I have patients who are funeral directors. There was a thing then, well, if somebody had amalgam fillings and you're going to cremate them, would you reduce the mercury emissions if you pulled the teeth out before you cremated them and then dealt with the teeth in another way? So, our general, humane view in the world is not to defile the dead. So they did studies, like some mercury amalgam removals and some not, and they found that the mercury emissions from the crematoria, there wasn't a huge difference between the two readings in people who had amalgam fillings their whole life in terms of the whole body. And what that meant was that if the mercury had left the oral cavity, there was so much of it in the rest of the body that it was immense.
Oh.
That there was a significant amount in human flesh as a result of amalgam fillings. See, the
Wow.
dentists don't see their patients after they die. So that led to crematoria having scrubbers to catch the mercury as it went in a vapor. So they decided, no, we're going to leave the dead. We're going to be respectful. We'll just catch the mercury and deal with it, correctly. So that's how much of a problem this is. Chocolate has cadmium and lead in it. It wasn't that long ago that the city of Los Angeles filed lawsuits against Hershey, Mars, and Kraft because of the amount of lead in their chocolate bars. It was a class action on account of the, and it's unusual for a government body to instigate a lawsuit like that. But the California is particularly what's the word? Mindful of heavy metals in, pregnancy and all that kind of thing. Anyway, so the question was, well, how could heavy metals like lead and cadmium get into these chocolate bars? Well, if you're using tailings, zinc tailings to fertilize the grass where the cows live, and the cow eats the grass, and a glass and a half of milk goes into every bar of chocolate, then you can see how that would occur, you see.
Yeah. Well,
So
wouldn't
it's
we
a
be
real
finding
thing.
it in all of the muscle meat as well, the steaks and the ribs and all the things.
Depends on what they're using for the fertilizers for the cows. See, technically, I don't know if you've read the book, The Omnivore's Dilemma,
Yes.
but it changed my life when I read that because farmers, cow farmers should be considered grass farmers, not cow farmers. So if you have your cows on grass, generally they're not using those sort of compounds on the grass. There's more omega-3 in the cow's milk and more omega-3 in their meat. And there's been studies to show, especially US Department of Agriculture do studies on omega-6 ratios in meat. And they found that grass-fed animals have higher levels of omega-3 compared to 6, and feedlot animals have lower levels of omega-3 compared to 6. So it's a pro-inflammatory product that's being made if you're not keeping your cows on grass. And the problem in the US is that you use corn to feed the cows. Because you've subsidized corn farming, it's really cheap for farmers to use that as the feed the cows. But that creates another issue, and that is that the cows are acidotic because they're on a high carb diet, and their microbiomes are significantly finicky. And if you don't put those cows onto grass 6 weeks before selling the cows, then you're going to have to give them an antibiotic to reduce the dangerous E. coli that they have in that cow. There's an E. coli strain that six of those organisms could kill a human. Six bacteria, that's how nasty they are. So they're the bad guys, the bad bunch of the E. coli. Anyway, so that, the subsidization of corn leading to the type of feed that animals get, which is definitely not physiological, creates another problem, a health issue. And that's one of the reasons that 75% of antibiotics are used by farmers and not doctors.
It's
They license
livestock.
them for that with the saying, oh, we want to prevent mastitis in the cows, but it's also in, so it's not just the dairy cows, it's the cows bred for meat. I mean,
Interesting.
as doctors, we should know about this food chain stuff.
Yeah.
We should
Yeah.
know where
Your
this
doctor should know.
our patients are eating it. And is it possible that when they come to us, they're suffering from a malady that's related to the food chain, apart from the
Yeah, or
obvious
I'm
ones
sure
like
there's all of these factors. I must have said, wow. When I edit this, I'll have to count how many times I said, wow. I'm still my brain is still reeling from the collection of the mercury vapors. I remember I had seen a video a long time ago that was associated with the Gerson therapy. I can't remember the deadly truth or the real truth. And they were showing this molar that had a filling in it. And they had this particular light on it and shadowed up against this backdrop. And they were taking just one of those dental tools and scratching the surface of the tooth. And the fumes, the vapors that were coming off of that tooth, just in that little tiny scratch. Think about all the things we eat that
Think
might
of
scratch
something
our.
that takes you a long time to chew,
But
like, and grind. The other thing that's going to happen when you've got amalgam fillings is you're going to swallow some of that mercury too. And that's going to go down into the gut. And mercury is an antibiotic. Okay, so it's one, that's, I guess, one of the reasons why it's been so successful in the mouth, because it, if you do have plaque and other things, they're not going to attack the filling because they're going to die when they contact it. But some, it wasn't that long ago that doctors were using mercury for therapeutic effects. Like, for instance, the treatment of syphilis was, we used to use mercurials. If you had syphilis, they'd give you mercury, and if you survived the mercury treatment, you have cured of the syphilis. So, that's, and it wasn't that long ago. Like, when I was a student, I remember in pharmacology, there was a we had what they call mercurial diuretics. So they had mercury in the diuretic as part of its structure. And then when that goes to the kidney, The mercury blocks the carbonic anhydrase and causes a diuresis. So that's specifically, and in the pharmacology book, it said the mechanism of action is that mercury blocks zinc, and it does. If you do that in the kidney, you'll get, a diuretic effect. So, if you swallow mercury, it's going to kill off the more fragile members of the microbiome, especially the Acidophilus, lactobacilli. So if you're swallowing that all the time, that's going to lead to a dysbiosis, which might cause another problem. And with some of the degenerative brain diseases, probably the best one studied is Parkinson's. If you kill off your lactobacilli, say, and one of the minor colonies takes over, and Citrobacter is one of the minor colonies, and it's a beta G producer. Just put throw that in. If that rises, what it does is it in some genetically predisposed people, it feeds back to the brain via the vagus nerve to the basal ganglia where you make dopamine, and it says, "Oh, you can take the next decade off. You don't need to work. You can, atrophy." And when you do that, the patient will start to get Parkinson's. Citrobacter freundii. And every so often, there's another one added to that group. And Citrobacter was the first one found to. You might have seen in your news feed gut bacteria causing Parkinson's disease. Have you ever get those? And it's that bug, Citrobacter, which is normally a minority group, but if the, if the primaries all pull out, and who's going to be president? So. It's the minority that can take over.
Those are
So,
the opportunistic bugs that
yeah,
have to be
exactly.
watched.
Well, you can't blame them. If you had nice houses, and then those people left on a long holiday and they didn't seem to come back, you might go, "Oh, I quite like Laurel Canyon. I think I might stay here. It's really cool."
Well,
So, yeah.
okay, before we get into Beta G's new album dropping, let me ask this last question before we get out of the real, we went into the weeds of the minerals, which I love, but on HTMA, so on hair tissue mineral analysis tests, when a patient goes through a calcium dump, a potassium dump, a sodium dump, how is that coming from the hair matrix? That doesn't make sense.
Look, you've got to be realistic about what hair samples are telling you. The only mineral that is dumped in the hair when in excess is copper. Okay, that's been shown. So it's just one of those things, and that's why some people have a coppery tinge to their hair. All right, so we don't get rid of sodium and potassium in hair samples. We've got the kidney for that. None of those other minerals are actually dumped in the hair. So if you see them rising, there's another meaning to it, and it depends on which ones. But typically, if you've got aluminium being excreted, you will almost always see a rise in sodium and potassium. And it's because aluminium is very acidic. So in the scalp, if you have aluminium passing through from the capillaries through to the hair matrix, that man in the middle, or person in the middle, if you're being politically correct, is going to react to the acidic change, the wave of acidity. So typically, what happens is to keep the peace, you need to raise alkaline minerals to counteract it. And this is exactly what happens in soils. So in Australia, we have issues with salinity, high levels of salt. And typically, that is in areas where the aluminium level is very high. So aluminium toxicity in Australian soils is one of the reasons why you can't grow anything in some of them, because the salt content is so high. Now, no one ever comments about the potassium, because potassium is a good thing in farming. If you have lots of potassium, you never get a complaint, because that saves them having to put potash on their farm, you see. So they never measure the potassium. They're not interested, but they see the sodium, because nothing can grow properly in sodium. It's like coastal sands, you know, only waxy kind of plants can grow there. You can't grow
Yeah, it's like
European
Florida.
type stuff. Yeah, so the what you see in hair samples is typically from aluminium, it'll be sodium, potassium, sometimes chromium will creep up as a result of that. There's another reason for that. But if it's, say, mercury being dumped, you might see calcium and magnesium going up because they're trying to counteract the acidic effect of that. And lead, too, is another one you might see. So, in the cathartic process, you've got to keep the balance. Now, the higher they go, it usually means that there's something really crucial that that cell doesn't have. So it might be iodine, for instance. So if that cell is low in iodine, and iodine is 1,000 times more alkaline than sodium, then you're going to get an amplification effect. It's a bit like having a float for a cash register. You know, every morning you've got to have $1,000 in the cash register. And so if you don't have enough, if you don't have any $100 bills, you're going to have more, you know, $5 bills and pennies and whatnot to keep the amount of money. So if you have $1,000 worth of pennies, that's really annoying. But at least you've balanced the cash register. Same with the hair sample. So the pivotal ones that cause the most issue are probably low iodines, that followed by low molybdenums, followed by low zinc, followed by low copper. So if any of those are low, you'll get an exaggerated effect of this reaction, you know, what they're calling a dump, but it's not really a dump because we've got better places to get rid of calcium. I mean, if you really had too many metals like that or elements in the body, would the hair be a very efficient place to get rid of them? Nah. You'd use the urine, wouldn't you? Yeah.
That's
So that's kind
interesting.
of my, and that's after looking at 15,000 of the bloody things.
Wow.
Yeah. And a lot of people write about these things, and I have to say, I'm probably the actual only practicing medical doctor who's ever written about hair samples. They're all lab people. I'm not saying anything bad about that, but that's not what their training is. They weren't trained to look after patients. They were trained to look after laboratory equipment. Whereas I was trying to look after patients, so I have a different view of those same tests because we, you know, the whole point of them is to make some kind of analysis, do some treatment, and measure them again to see if you're right. Whereas almost all of the books that I've ever read on this subject were based on the first hair analysis, and no one has ever written about sequential hair samples except me. And what
Wow.
happens if, what do you do? What happens if you do this? If you give iodine to someone who has a low iodine, what would you expect next? None of them have written about that. And in my books, I've given several, maybe sometimes up to six sequential hair samples to show exactly what happens as you tweak and manipulate the biochemistry of somebody. And it's not always, I mean, that's where the term hidden copper overload comes from. Anyway, so people have written about this stuff, but at the time there might have been holes in their literature at which have been filled since then. Like, for instance, the fact that copper excretion will use glutathione to the expense of other metals like mercury and arsenic when it's high. Now, you won't find that in any of those books because that was published way after, in a very esoteric piece of literature. But you know, that's how I found out about it. So what you used to find is the first hair samples, you see high copper, it's a dump. And you might not see any mercury, and then after the copper comes down, suddenly you see all this mercury come out. And you think, well, what happened here? Why couldn't I see it on the first hair sample? So these people are writing about the first one and making all these claims, but they've never done a second one and a third and a fourth and a seventh. And for years I was trying to figure out what that was, and I found the reason for it, that when copper zinc ratio is really high, like over six, copper will use glutathione. It just steals that for convenience and do that until the levels come down. So nobody else can use the glutathione, thanks very much. So as the copper comes down, suddenly all this glutathione is available. And the liver says, oh, thank God for that, because I've had all this mercury here for 20 years. And then you see the dump of mercury. Yeah.
Where does metallothionein come into play when it comes to metals and glutathione, or is that just
Yeah.
another glutathione?
It there's a series of metallic defense systems, depending on how you look at it. I tend to dump them all together. So, for instance, lipoic acid, I don't know if you've heard of that, as a that's a metallic defense system, because you can store copper, nickel, cobalt, and cadmium in lipoic acid. You metallothionein, you can store mercury or cadmium. Another one, glutathione, you can temporarily store arsenic and mercury, because often glutathione is sacrificed in the process of removing something. So you bind it to glutathione and or selenium, and then that goes out in the bile. So a lot of the defenses, it can be either sacrificial or defensive. So metallothionein is a defensive and a sacrificial metallic defense system. So there are six forms of glutathione that cover the body. You've got it in the skin, 66% is in the gut. Then you've got the brain, liver, and a few other places. So each tissue makes metallothionein differently based on the genetics of it. So some people are really good at making metallothionein, and some people are not so good at making glutathione. Oh, sorry, metallothionein. Metallothionein is like a big ball of sulfur with seven zinc atoms. Okay, so what it does is it comes along to a tissue. It might be the scalp, and it says, "Oh, you've got a mercury atom there. Would you like to swap it for my lovely zinc atom?" So you get this exchange system, a bit like zeolites and silicates, and then you slowly use exchange all of the seven spots for a heavy metal, and then it goes to the kidney for filtering. And that's one of the reasons why cadmium exposure causes kidney failure in people, because if there's so much of that cadmium being attached to metallothionein and it's all going back to the recycle plant, eventually the plant gives up. And that's the problem with metallothionein. If you are good at making it, then you're going to put more strain on another organ as a result of that. And on hair samples, what you find is the zinc's high, because in that area, if you have a lot of methionine coming in, sorry, metallothionein coming in, then you're going to see a lot more zinc present in that tissue, simply because it's protecting you. So let's say it's cadmium and you see cadmium on the hair sample. As you bring the cadmium down, you find the zinc falls as well, because you don't need to make so much metallothionein to deal with it. So that you don't see that unless you've done thousands of hair samples and done, sequential hair samples and know what you gave in between the two sample t times, etc. Yeah,
So
so these things are
complex.
protective.
So
Yeah,
complex really is.
I know, it's everything's connected to everything.
Well, so the excretion discussion makes me think of hormones and the Dutch test and
Yeah.
how we can and so when I do the Dutch, I don't recommend the Dutch for people because I for people who just want to know their hormone levels because it's just not accurate at that because it's just showing us what's being excreted. And so we really don't know why, what their levels in circulation are. But we do see in page three of the Dutch Complete, we see the detoxification process, and that brings us to hormones and the gut. And we can see in the liver, what pathways they're favoring. So, like the 2OH, 4OH, or the 16OH pathways, the phase one and phase two liver detox. So, tell us about that process and, gut health and hormones and gut health, basically.
Well, look, to elimination as a subject, again, comes back to if it's serious, Mother Nature will always make sure there's more than one way to do it. So, okay, so let's talk about why, what's this all about? The first thing is the two components in terms of getting rid of things you don't want. Sometimes Mother Nature is very clever and she'll put two things she doesn't want in the same thing. For instance, bilirubin, the color that makes you jaundice. She will put one bilirubin and two of these glucuronic acid compounds together to be sure, and she's got rid of two glucuronic acids and a bilirubin in the poo. And that's what makes the poo darker, is that color. Now, estrogens go through that way, but you can only add one glucuronic acid to an estrogen. But you'd be surprised to know that ethanol also can be excreted that way, and paracetamol or Tylenol in your language. And so the four of them are being removed from the body using exactly the same pathway. And this is one of the reasons why women should only be having no more than three standard drinks per week, because their estrogens are being removed through this mechanism, the alcohol is being removed through this mechanism. So you can imagine binge drinking and then taking your Tylenol the next morning for the hangover. Repeat until it's a dangerous level. So that's the reason why alcohol intake is really quite problematic in females. So this thing, this glucuronic acid, is the one of the last steps before, in the days where organisms like us could make vitamin C ourselves and not outsource it,
We
we'd
did.
start with glucose and then we convert it to vitamin C. So for instance, an 80 kilogram goat makes 13 grams of vitamin C every day. So for the FDA to say that an 80 kilogram human only needs 68 milligrams, it's a bit of a leap of faith, isn't it? But anyway, they probably don't read animal studies. So when you get 90% of the way down, you get this glucuronic acid. And so you're stuck with it in a way. So you think, well, how can I get rid of it? I know. I've got an estrogen. I'll bind it to that. I've got some bilirubin. I'll bind it to that. Oh, she's been drinking. I'll bind it to that. So you can get rid of two things at once. Now, the importance of that is glucuronic acid is actually a good marker of longevity. So as we age, the glucuronic acid levels slowly rise to a point where we can't deal with it anymore. And that's an impediment in liver function. And you might have read, oh, there's a blood test that'll tell you how long you're going to live. It's probably that one.
Really?
Yeah. So glucuronic acid, it's better to get it out than in. So it's convenient to dump two things. You've got, two bits of rubbish, you dump them together, glucuronic acid plus estrogen, and send it out in the poo. But then what happens is we have a recycling system. Just the same as the kidneys throw away stuff and then changes its mind, we have a system like that for estrogens. Now, if you have a look at the profile of estrogen over a menstrual cycle, can you see that?
Yep, we're
You
looking
notice there's a
at
peak here. It could be like 1,000, 1,400, and then there's another little peak. That is actually the recycled estrogen from that first peak. It's come back. The beta
So we're okay,
glucuronidase
the
has created
estrogen peak, the little
it.
estrogen peak at the end.
In the end, yeah.
Okay.
So why is that? I mean, if you think about it, if you want to get rid of it, get rid of the stuff. But why would you want to take some of it back? And the reason is that it comes back to, the 100 functions of estrogen. They're not, it's not just secondary sex characteristics. Why do you need that in the second half of your cycle if you're not going to have a baby and you want to wait till next time? So I'll read you something interesting that came out of the World of Diabetes Journal. The main estrogens have been studied essentially related to their classical estrogenic functions. However, The main effect in the body is probably the sustained control of core energy metabolism.
Whoa.
Yeah, so what they do, they facilitation of insulin secretion and control of glucose availability, modulation of energy partition, favoring the use of lipids as the main energy substrate when more available than carbohydrate. Does this sound familiar with the fast? Yeah. Functional protection through antioxidant mechanisms and central effects on the whole body energy management. That's what their job is. That is their day job.
Now, is
So, of
that a
course, you
job
don't want
that's
to
like a,
run out.
is it like a backup thing though, or it like an
No, it's the
emergency?
main player. It's not Beyonce at the Super Bowl. It's the game. Okay? It's the game. And this is why it's the dumbest name you could think of. Remember last week I said, like, secondary sex characteristics is only one of its 100 functions. Well, I mean, this is the naivety of how people report these things. This is the world, this is the Global Journal of Diabetes and Metabolic Management. Okay, that's, and they're saying that estrogen's function is predominantly related to energy. So, of course, you don't want to run out of the stuff because you'll fall on a heap. You want to make sure there's an, you don't waste the stuff. And so, if it seems like there's the levels are dropping and you need a bit of a boost, your beta-glucuronidase enzymes just recycle it, and you've got a bit more there for a while. And the ovary doesn't have to do a thing; it's done its peak and it's taken the rest of the cycle off. So it's part of a management system that is much bigger than just elimination. It's to do with glucose control. And if you think about it, that glucuronic acid is made from glucose. So you don't want to run out of that either. See, so it's a feedback system that says, I need enough glucose to function properly. Plus, I want to get rid of my toxins, but I don't want to get rid of all of my estrogens if I could. If I can help, because I don't want to run out. It's just as problematic as running out of progesterone. Estrogen is one of the first requirements for the innate immune system. It's important for stimulating interferon one. And if you look at actuarial studies, women get less infections and have less deaths from things like COVID. And it's because if you can make interferon early enough, you can signal to the rest of the immune system that there's a problem early on. Okay. And then the immune system can come in a timely way and deal with it. For instance, Houston, we have a problem. Would Mission Control want to know early if there's a problem, or would they be waiting to the command modules hurtling towards the White House? They would like to know early, So, and it's the same with the immune system. So the estrogens are instrumental in setting off the alarm. And that's why there are fewer deaths, fewer infections for females, because you've got more of that hormone.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, because you're the breeder, we don't want you to die. Well, not unless you're a really horrible wife. But anyway, so yeah, you can see how it's more than one thing going on here. Sure, we want to get rid of xeno, and then xenobiotics come along and mess the whole thing up. Because what if the same situation of, oh, don't throw that out, came along from that point of view? So the microbiome, 24% of the gut bugs that live in our microbiome make this enzyme that recycles the estrogens back. And one of the groups, notable ones, is a group called the Cholinsella. And the Cholinsella also have another function. They're the ones that activate your bile salts. So the liver makes the bile salts, but you still don't have any fat-soluble weaponry there, fat-absorbing weaponry, until these gut bacteria activate it. And the beta-glucuronidase is a bit like that as well. The activation or the cleaving of the estrogens is part of a benevolent thing, But the biggest ones are that we see, because we do a lot of microbiomes, Bifidobacterium, E. coli, and Lactobacilli are the top group that are making this beta-glucuronidase. So why is it that some of these, what you know, because when we do stool samples, you can measure the beta-glucuronidase activity
Beta G.
In the microbiomes and comprehensive digestive stool analyses. So when it creeps up, whose fault is that? Well, it's not the good guys. It, you know, the E. coli, bifidobacteria, Bacteroides, lactobacillus. It's not them. It's the opportunists that are causing the problem, and that's Citrobacter and Clostridium. Those ones are the unwanted guests, right? They, it's like a football team you hate, and they turn up for dinner. They, they're the ones causing the trouble in dysbiosis. So when we talk about dysbiosis, you shouldn't really blame the beta-glucuronidase. You should blame the bacteria that are producing it, that someone didn't stop them. And you almost always see Citrobacter or high levels of Clostridium when you find low levels of lactobacilli, bifido species or Bacteroides. They're just bad pennies. They turn up. They want to run the place by dysbiosis creating this problem. And it means that if you're looking at the half-life of DDT in the body, it's a lot worse when you have dysbiosis. People have proven that. There's a high level of hepatic intrahepatic circulation of xenobiotics when you have a dysbiotic. And it's the same in the ground. People say, oh, the half-life of DDT is only 30 years in the ground. Well, that's if you have decent soils and they're alkaline. If they're not, the half-life's a lot longer, thank you very much. So we're the same. In a healthy environment, we can get rid of these things, protect ourselves, deal with excesses, etc., as long as our gut bacteria is benevolent to us. And some of that actually, believe it or not, comes back to our own genetics. We support certain types of bacteria, especially these ones that make the beta-glucuronidase. The bifidobacterium, that group, they survive better if you have a gene called FUT2 and you are considered to be a secretor, because your gut will support that particular microbiome. If you don't have that gene, if you have full SNPs for it, then you will always struggle with low levels of bifidobacterium, which means that you won't have the full complement of your beta-glucuronidase group. And they found that, ironically, people with low levels of bifidobacterium long-term are more likely to get autoimmune disorders and cancers. And the corollary of that is they've actually done studies to give that group of bacteria to patients therapeutically for autoimmune disorders and cancers.
So are the colonies that make beta-glucuronidase, is that the astrobilome? Is that the what we refer to as the astrobilome?
I thought that was a sports arena in
in Laramie,
New Mexico. The estrobilome. We're playing at the estrobilome.
Oh my goodness!
Oh, sorry, I had to. I'm just a naughty Australian, and I have to get my jokes in. All right. So, yeah, it's the. I mean, I always thought a better name would be the estrobiome, but nobody listened to me on it. Yeah, it's to do with the how the gut influences the hormones. But there should be an androbilome too. I think that would be fair. The guy's probably listening going, oh, why don't we have an androbilome? I'd love that. So, yes, it's to do with that. It's a big thing, because these bugs that live in our gut are migrant workers. They've got 1.5 pounds of gut bacteria. That means that you have, for every cell in your body, you have a gut bacteria equal 1 to 1.
Amazing.
And we have a virome, and you'd be horrified to know that for every cell in our body, we have 2 viruses. Lord knows what they're doing there. That will be another rabbit hole. We
waiting.
Can go down.
Yeah. They're waiting.
So, okay. So but you can see that it's really in the bigger picture is, that The estrobilome only really comes into being when you've run out of choices with other mechanisms of estrogen management. It's like having an extra exit in a building. Like, for instance, if you, I'll send these through to you. The reason that this looks so complicated is that you need more than one exit for these things. The mechanisms that control it. Sure, you can send them off in the poo. You can sulfate them. You can, what is that? Sorry, you gluconeuride them, or you can bind them to fatty acids. For instance, arachidonic acid and palmitic acid and oleic acid. These are the types of esters that are formed in estrogen. So in adipose tissue, so the estrogen is bound to a fatty acid and then sent to adipose tissue, and it's actually more estrogenic when you do it that way. This is why they say estrogens build up in adipose tissue. So you're sending them there to be stored because the fatty acid part is very fat soluble. It's like, olive oil, palm oil. So you use these fats to store the estrogen. And you lock them up in adipose tissue. So they're stored there long term, create, and they're more estrogenic in that form. So why have you got all these choices? Or you can just say, I feel like I'm more masculine today. And you convert it with aromatase to testosterone and go, okay, well, you can deal with that.
Wait, you can aromatize estrogen into testosterone?
Absolutely. It's a two-way thing.
What?
You can go either way. You can go from testosterone to estrogen, or you can go back the other way. So most enzymes are like that. And the androgen-estrogen balance, obviously is different for males and females. This is where the chromosome thing comes into it. So for men, aromatase generally has an effect that any estrogens that comes along tends to get shunted off to aromatase. And in the Dutch, you can actually see the aromatase effect and you can see the compt. And one of the good things I like about the Dutch is if you're trying to figure out functionally what the compt is going on in this person, the Dutch will kind of tell you it and it completely. Independent of the genetics, because there's so many things. Compt is the bane. If you look at this side of the compt here, we're going up to the catechol O-methyltransferase. Well, what this means is the estrogens have an oxygen atom on them, and it's at the bottom there where we go. Yeah, so the estrogens like in this end here. That O can be bound to something else. You can pull the hydrogen off and then bind it to SAMe, for instance. So the compt is a backup of a backup of a backup because generally you don't want to send estrogens down that pathway because you're going to mess up your neurotransmitter pathways. Especially if you have a tendency to have high levels of adrenaline, you don't really want to poke the bear there. So you really would be better off to poo them, sulfate them. Or bind them to fatty acid esters and just sort of tuck them away for a while until you can think of what to do with these things. So that's why we have so many exit points for these things. It just, alcohol's the same. Panadol, Tylenol's the same. You want to have a backup of a backup of a backup when you're dealing with something serious. That's
So,
where the complexity of the estrogen. So who's controlling this? How do we know? How much estrogen should the estrobilome return back to the bloodstream? One thing that isn't so obvious about this cycle is that the blood returning from the gut goes to the liver first. It's not circulating out where you would take a blood test, for instance, like the radial artery or in your antecubital fossa. It's a separate cycle. It's a bit like the lung. When the blood leaves the right side of the heart and goes through the lung and comes back, you can't sample that fluid. Well, you can with a 16-gauge needle and a very good aim, but generally you can't sample what's going in there, or Swan-Ganz catheter. I'll put that in. So the what's going on in the gut circulation, or what so the gut gets the heart pumps, it goes down through the superior mesenteric artery, goes through to the intestine, but when it comes back, it doesn't use the same capillary venous system as the leg, for instance. It's compartmentalized. So it's harder to get an analysis of that. So some when we talk about, oh, it's absorption from the gut, it's actually several filters that protect it from the peripheral circulation or the main circulation. And that isn't so obvious unless you read the anatomy and physiology of that area. So then it's the liver who's deciding whatever comes up from the gut, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to let it through, across the border? Am I going to hold it up and do a strip search? Am I going to store it? No, it's very much like, a customs border. What will happen to things coming from the gut? And we know that a liver has a certain capacity, and then you can be overrun. And like people with leaky gut, for instance, I don't know if you've come across that term when it comes to the, if you have a lot of, and the people with leaky gut are more likely to absorb the cleaved estrogens because they will fit nicely through the gap. So if you don't have leaky gut, even if your system fails and you cleave those estrogens and the glucuronic acid, the chances are, and if you have a good elimination time, you'll have plenty of time to poo them out. But if you're a bit on the slow side, transit time, and you've got some leaky gut and you've got upregulated beta glucuronidase, you're going to be in a bit of trouble because more of those toxins, xenobiotics, and endogenous estrogens will go back to the liver. So
Eesh.
there's more, still more to it than the beta glucuronidase. This is where the backup of the backups of the backups go, and why we have so many fail safes for these things.
So where does calcium deglucarate come in, and why would we want to use the calcium deglucarate?
If the liver's on board, then oral calcium deglucarate will be converted to glucuronic acid. Okay. It's not, sometimes in therapeutics, where you think the thing's going to work might not be where it's going to be. And I'll give you an example. So if we take the word glucuronic acid, there's two parts to that. There's the gluco part, which means sweet in Greek, and then uronic acid, because that was first found in urine. But that uronic acid has a day job, and it's to make things like dermatin, keratin, heparin, chondroitin, and the girls will all know this one, hyaluronic acid. Have you heard of that? It's in makeups and fillers and
It's
stuff.
in
So
everything.
it's not really hyaluronic acid, it's hyal uronic acid, the same as glucuronic acid. Okay. So it has a lot more functions than just being tossed out in the poo. For the process of getting rid of estrogens, the whole body needs the damn stuff for the skin, nails, joints, coagulation or anticoagulation. So when you give calcium deglucarate, you can't tell the body, oh, I don't want you to make chondroitin with that. I want you to use it in the liver to get rid of estrogens. It's, you have to give quite a bit before you apportion enough for, estrogen detoxification, or it might be used for bilirubin, or it might be used for ethanol, or it might be used for Tylenol. So it could work. It could work. You've got to give enough, and the circumstances have to be favorable for it. So yeah, no, I believe in calcium deglucarate. The naturopaths use it. I've used it
I mean,
in
if
my
you're
integrative
already
medicine.
having sluggish pathways, like if you're already, favoring unhealthy pathways, do you want to say, well, yeah, I mean, is it worth just trying? Like, for example, I don't like to recommend diindole methane to women who, unless they know they have a high 16-OH, path. If they don't, If they don't, then a lot of times women get worse on diethylmethane. So
Yeah.
is CDG similar? Like, could you just try it just to see if
I
it helps
think
you?
you'll have less problems of calcium deglucurate.
Okay.
Because
Wow.
if it isn't used for that purpose, the body will find something to do with it. You know, it's one of those all-rounders that could be used for a whole lot of things. But then you could give glucose and that would work because the glucose will be converted to glucuronic acid in the liver. But yeah, because that's what it's made from. That's the original substrate is glucose. And this is, you know, if you look phylogenetically at other animal groups, cats and goats can still make vitamin C from glucose. But there's a particular enzyme that was deleted, and it probably wasn't a very good idea. Sorry, God. So, because it means now we have to grow citrus and cherries and guavas and
Why do you think that
African.
happened?
I don't know. Maybe they're trying to kill us. Maybe the engineers who created us from another planet built that in to try to get rid of the
Away. Let's
human.
get rid of them slowly. Well, that goes to
Yeah.
back to the fasting thing where it's like where women are on these low carb or no carb or keto, no carb,
Yeah.
paleo, no carb, carnivore, no carb.
It's possible they don't have the mechanisms that would normally do all that for them, aren't working, you know. And maybe they are low on estrogen, and maybe, you know, we should be thinking of estrogen as a metabolic management system. The question is how much should we have, you know, what's the normal range for it? What's the ideal for it? When do you step in and substitute for it? Yeah, I don't know. That's another rabbit hole.
Really quickly about estrogen and tissue. So, like we're recycling, if that we're getting into perimenopause and menopause, our estrogen's going into tissues and out of circulation, our progesterone has dropped. And let's go back to that testosterone aromatization thing because I'm really,
Yeah.
really curious. So, does the aromatization happen can it happen in one, like for example, on my chin? Can I
Yeah.
be aromatizing estrogen on my chin into testosterone
Yeah.
and growing hair
Because
here?
skin has
Yet
different
here,
ratios of, yeah.
it
Yeah.
does something different here. And on my breast, it
Yeah.
does something different here.
Yeah.
Can
Yeah.
really? So it can
It's
act. Okay.
yeah, and it's to do there's a few things there that we've got two types of estrogen receptors, the ER alpha and ER beta, and they react differently to estrogens. And then each tissue, the aromatase, even within genders, the aromatase setting is different. Like, for instance, in bone. One of the reasons you need localized estrogen in bone in males and females is to prevent breakdown of bone, osteoclasts. So you want bone at least to have the aromatase setting favoring the estrogens, even in males. Okay. So, you know, and all pathways in the body that don't need an enzyme. So you can interconvert testosterone and estrogen using a non-enzymatic pathway. It actually uses the mineral boron. And this is why people use boron for bone density. And if you give boron, you can have almost an estrogenic effect on bone density because it can convert the double O to an OH through a non, it's slower, but it still works. So that's why boron is used in bone formulas.
Interesting, because I have heard women have estrogenic effects from when they use boron, and they say, I think it raises my estrogen. A lot of women say that. So
Yeah,
that's
because it bypasses aromatase. It has an aromatase type effect. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I guess just lastly, although yeah, so what facilitates aromatase? Like I know that I've heard melatonin is an aromatase inhibitor. I've
Yeah.
heard
I was going to show you
aspirin.
that. Maybe I can. I stored a really good slide on the other computer that didn't allow me to use Zoom, but what I might do is show it on the screen. This is an idea that I came up with, how estrogens can be mitogenic or anti-mitogenic. It's actually based on John R. Lee's book, What Your Doctor Might Tell You About Breast Cancer, I think. So there are certain things that can facilitate the how E1 is estrone is metabolized. So, for instance, if you want to send it down the bad, you want to block the production of 4-hydroxy, you've got selenium, curcumin, resveratrol, and rosemary as herbs that can be used for that. And if you want to send it down the good guys, this is where your cruciferous vegetables, your calcium deglucarate, indole 3-carbinol, and rosemary, and lignans can send it down that way. And if you can support COMT, then you've got a really good exit. And then
16
with
hydroxy, 16 hydroxy can be quite potentially dangerous as well, though, no? That 16-OH is usually like clotty periods and stuff like that, like heavy cycles and
yeah, but it's estrogenic, but not necessarily in the mitogenic
okay.
aspect. Yeah.
Got it.
It has a potent effect. Where was the other thing I was going to show you? Oh yeah, can you see that? See, so testosterone comes from cholesterol, and so this switch can either send it down to E2, or you can send it back to dihydrotestosterone. But see where the resveratrol and the lignans here and nettle. So a lot of naturopaths will use nettle and zinc as aromatase blockers,
Okay,
zinc
that's
in
funny because
particular.
that's what I'm
So,
drinking right now.
yep. And so I've actually used zinc. Now, zinc works better in males as a aromatase blocker than females. I don't know why. Maybe it's a dose thing. And so you see the saw palmetto, nettle and zinc also help. So quite a few formulas have that, like for prostate health, hair loss, that kind of thing. I used the right term there, pro-cancer. Yeah, okay. So there are ways of influencing aromatase using natural compounds. I'm not an expert on this. I leave this to the naturopaths, but I know that they tweak things, and there's other stuff as well, like Tongkat Ali. Yeah, there's a few other herbs that are famous
And
for
is
helping.
melatonin an aromatase inhibitor as well? Or is that, do I have that wrong?
I don't think it is, and the reason is that men recharge their testosterone at night. So the irony of it is that you need testosterone to have a refreshing sleep, but then you recharge your testosterone overnight as well. So circadian dysrhythmia is associated with low testosterone levels. It's a bit like a electric car. You know, when you're braking, you recharge the battery, but you can't start the car if you don't have a charged battery. So yeah, that's what I don't think. That's why I don't think melatonin is a testosterone aromatase inhibitor, because the men need all the help they can get with testosterone for the cycling and recharging overnight. I'd have to look that up, but my first thought is I don't think it is.
Okay. Well, one more question before we I let you go, unless you can think of other things you want to add. And that is, can you speak a little bit on iron? Because it comes up a lot. I'm not a fan in my group for women to supplement it. I think women are always chasing ferritin levels and they're always chasing iron, and the doctors seem to think it's the root of their issues. And I think that it's I always say it's a defi it's a it's a deficiency of other things. And it's usually why most women don't feel better when they take iron. They feel worse oftentimes. So I just discourage it because I don't want people to come into my group and get this message that, they should be taking iron. So what do you have to say about iron?
It's a really complex question because the blood tests don't always tell you the true nurture about iron. It's one of those things that I've seen people with ferritins of 9 who are completely fine. So what does that mean? Does that mean they become tolerant to low iron? There's, again, if it's serious, Mother Nature has other ways of dealing with it. Now, one of the things about the trace elements are particularly the cations, the divalent cations, so compounds that have 2+ charges like iron, molybdenum, manganese, copper, zinc, is that they can muck in for each other. So, for instance, molybdenum can muck in for iron. It can be the cofactor in pathways that iron uses. And same with manganese. It is often a crossover, a substitution. It's a bit like, you're making a recipe and you don't have any stevia. You can use monk fruit, sorry. So the same thing with the trace elements, which means that if you have an abundant amount of manganese, you might be able to tolerate a ferritin 7 because the manganese is working in, as a cofactor in the enzymes that would normally have iron. Okay, until you run out of manganese or molybdenum. And that's why the threshold for being symptomatic from iron deficiency can be varied and why it seems to be confusing. I have patients with that, and the asymptomatic ones had really good levels of these other trace elements, so they were able to substitute for the iron because a lot of things can do iron's job. The second thing is that persistent anemia, if despite iron therapy, can be due to copper deficiency. And the reason is that if you've got hemoglobin, it's a bit like a car, and the hemoglobin is the engine, and the copper is the crane that puts the engine into the car. So if the copper's missing, you can't put the hemoglobin into the red cells. So it's again, it's due the iron problem is aggravated by another deficiency, in this case, copper. So yeah, there's a tolerance effect. There's an interaction with other divalent cations. And then the other thing about iron is, the reference ranges for iron are a bit misleading as well. For instance, if you look at the upper limit of ferritin over the last 30 years, it's got higher and higher and higher. So if you're trying to say, oh, I should be a lot higher than what I am, you should be thinking, why is the reference range rising at the top end? And it's because iron, there's studies to show that longevity is actually associated with lower levels of iron. So if you have a bell-shaped curve, the longevity is better if you're on the left-hand side of the curve than the right-hand side of the curve. And that's because, iron could be considered to be pro-inflammatory and it's a burden to store it. So the other thing about ferritins is sometimes you can have normal ferritins and have low levels of iron in the tissues. I'll give you a really good example of this. In restless leg syndrome, we often will give iron. It's a sign that the person needs iron, but when you do the blood tests, the ferritin might be normal. So they did studies with MRIs of the brain. So you can tune an MRI to look for particular metals. And they found that in all of these patients with restless legs, the brain iron was deficient. It was lower than the normal range, but the serum iron and the ferritin were normal. So when they gave iron, the problem improved. And that's because each tissue uses iron differently and has different storage components. So, for instance, the skin doesn't have much iron in it, really, compared to the liver or muscle. And I remember I did 6 months of hematology, and we would see the patient, we'd take a bone marrow, plate it out, report the test. And so many times we saw iron deficiency on the bone marrow sample and normal levels of ferritin. And I remember asking the consultants this. They said the bone marrow, the tissue sample, is the gold standard. The ferritin is only helpful if it's high or low. If it's normal, don't hang your hat on that.
Wow.
So there's a lot of, and the other thing we found out about ferritin, and this goes back to the 50s, there are other minerals that can sit in ferritin's parking spot. The ferritin's like a big canister, and you can store iron in there. Its primary function is if bacteria invade you, they're looking for the iron. That's the spoils of war. So you drop the serum iron, you put it into the ferritin, you raise the copper to piss them off, and then until you win the war, and then you go the other way. The copper goes down, take the iron out of ferritin, and it goes down again. So it's called an acute phase reactant.
Wow.
So unfortunately, you can store other things in a canister. For instance, anything that has a 3+ charge, like aluminium, can also be stored in that. And that's one of the ways that aluminium crosses the blood-brain barrier to cause problems in the brain. And all the buses that transfer iron, like transferrin, you can have heavy metals. So you can store mercury, you can store lead in ferritin canisters as well, which means that all your assessments of nutrition for iron are completely out the window because there's somebody else in the canister. So it's a complicated thing, iron. It's not as simple as just take more iron. And the other thing is, if you're low in iron, is it possible you're low in a whole lot of other trace elements? I tested this hypothesis when I first started working. I read that zinc is needed to make stomach acid, and you need stomach acid to create ionized elements. These divalent cations, calcium, magnesium, iron, zinc, etc. So I had the hypothesis that, well, if you were low in zinc first, you wouldn't have enough stomach acid to absorb your iron either from your diet or your supplements. And the reason is that people who create supplements assume you can absorb the thing that you're low in. That's their primary assumption. Whereas they should be thinking, perhaps the reason they're low is they can't absorb the thing I'm giving them. Anyway, that's another story. So when I gave zinc and remeasured the iron, it came up because now I was giving them enough zinc to make a stomach acid to absorb the dietary iron. So there's a lot of ways. The question about it is, why are they low in iron? And you have to fix the why. Giving the iron might work some of the time, but the why is it slow? And everyone assumes, oh, you're a menstruating female, of course you're going to lose your iron. And there's some truth in that iron is actually important for clotting. And the reason we know this is that when we give iron infusions to females, they all say, my periods are lighter now. And that cutoff point's about 40. It's about ferritin 40. I'm not sure what it is in US measurements in the imperial. So if you can at least get the iron up over that level, they suddenly can clot properly, which means they don't lose more iron, which means that they don't bleed, which means they don't lose more iron. So there's a lot to this.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, I was anemic and I had to have infusions and I was having terrible periods and the infusions just made me terribly ill. And so did the iron supplements. But it just sounds like it's just not that easy. You can't just assume to take these things just because
One of
you're.
the side effects of iron therapy is it drops the phosphate level, and the symptoms of phosphate deficiency are quite severe because you can't make energy without the phosphate. The ATP, the energy currency, well, the P is phosphate. So if your iron infusion drops your phosphate, that means that you can't make ATP for weeks at a time. And that's a side effect that a lot of doctors don't know, that maybe you should pre-treat the patient with phosphate supplements before you give an iron infusion. And
Interesting.
the other thing is that some people are too active after they've had the infusion. And so instead of the iron being deposited in the hematopoietic system, the bone marrow, liver, and spleen, it goes into muscles and joints and the synovium of the joints, and it causes aching muscles and aching joints. You've got to be really strict about the amount of activity you do for the next 24 hours after an iron infusion. It's a whole talk in itself, iron and metabolism and You can sort of see why some people might be tolerant of low irons. If they had plenty of other trace elements, that would do the job.
Yeah.
They'd just muck in and fill the gaps.
I mean, I ended up with a blood transfusion and then afterwards felt like Superwoman for a while and then started to have the same issues happening. But then I just started to, eat better, get some exercise, use progesterone, magnesium, get my vitamin D levels up. And I never struggled with it again. Vitamin C.
I'll send
Never
you a
went wrong.
paper. Vitamin D is another. I had another epiphany in the last few years trying to figure out what the connection between vitamin D and the low levels of these minerals. It actually turns out that vitamin D has an influence on the absorption of not just calcium, but magnesium, iron, copper, zinc, and manganese. So if the D is low, you cannot absorb those trace elements effectively, and sometimes the low D is responsible for the low iron. And it's another piece of esoteric literature that's stuck out somewhere in a, Journal of Theoretical Gastroenterology or whatever. But it made a lot of sense to me, and I've applied that since then, and it always seems to work that the D is there as a messenger to the gut to say, if you see these minerals, you damn well absorb them. Don't send them past here. We want them in here. And it's not just calcium. Calcium was the obvious one, but it's all of those. So if you get all your ducks in a row, you get your D well, your D proper, not proper, but optimal, it was zinc optimal, your probability of absorbing your trace elements is boosted by about 5 to 10 times.
Wow, that makes so much sense. That ties it all together for me, really. And so you don't have a problem with vitamin D supplementation. Do you recommend it with K, or how do you feel
I
about
give
that?
almost all my patients that. It depends on your, like, if it's for bone, you definitely want to put K in there. It's very hard to overdose on vitamin D. I've only ever had one patient do it, and that's because she didn't listen to my instructions. Her naturopath kept saying, "Oh no, you need more than that. You need to get it higher than that." And she was quite sick, and we're trying to figure out what it was, and it was that, she it was too many cooks spoil the broth. But in general, it's really hard, especially if you start in a deficient range, very hard to overdose on vitamin D. Very, very hard.
Interesting. Well, that would be so I would love to do another episode, and I want to do a blood type,
You're addicted now, aren't you?
and then I want to do an iron and D and really delve into that one of these days. I just feel like
Well,
these
it's
are
so important. 12% of the global population are low in iron. That's a significant number of people, and they're mostly women and children.
Well, what about the iron recycling system? Why doesn't that what's happening to that that's breaking down the because isn't that like 65% of our iron comes from that recycling system or something?
It's all this comes back to, if the recycling system is going back to the liver, you're completely at the mercy of the liver's decision. Now, they did some interesting studies. They radio labeled different minerals to see what the circulation was doing with them. So they started with iron, then they did manganese and chromium. So when they gave iron to the liver, in some situations, the iron would get absorbed, it'd go through the intestine, back up through the venous system to the liver, and the liver would say, "Oh, we've got heaps of that. Go back out in the bile." And the same chromium and manganese, that the liver was making incorrect decisions about the storage at the back. It looked it's sort of like delivering to a big warehouse, and they're going, "Oh, I can see that that whole aisle is full of boxes. So therefore, we don't need you. Go back to the distributor." Whereas what was in those boxes wasn't so obvious from looking at them on the outside. So it could have been mercury or lead or aluminium. You see? So if the boxes appear full, the liver decides, "Oh, we don't need that." And this is one of the reasons people have failed with iron supplementation. And in fact, supplementation with a lot of trace elements was that the incorrect assessment of the liver of Notitia. Yep, they could see it on the radioactive thing. The radio labeled supplement was absorbed, went up, went back to the liver, and down the bile. And
Wow.
not even a negotiation about, oh, maybe I'll just keep some in case.
I mean, I didn't even know you could do that. Radio label a nutrient and then follow it
Yeah,
through the body.
it
That's
was in
amazing.
an era where ethical approval was probably a lot easier than today.
So it was in a person that they did that.
Oh,
Wow.
people, yeah, they did volunteers because
Okay.
they were trying to answer the same question. Why is it that these supplements, what's wrong with it? Is it possible that, the liver's miscalculating what the storage is? Or is it the form of the iron that the body thinks, because it's in an ionic form, it might be a heavy metal that's dangerous?
Yeah.
Whereas in a chelate, it might not be so threatening, is it word?
Yeah.
I don't know. This probably I always assume that this because the liver's miscalculated the nutriture, the storage in its warehouse.
I mean, I always say, you're probably going to cringe, but I always say, you know, like I think when we supplement or isolate, take a supplement in isolation or mineral in isolation or a vitamin in
No,
isolation. I feel
you're
like
absolutely right. And also, the other thing is that people say, "Oh, you know what? I feel really good, but I don't feel I need to take those things every day. I take them, you know, 3 times a week or when I feel like it." And I'd say that's perfectly reasonable. We don't eat the same thing every day unless you're in prison or aged care. Why should you take the same supplements every day?
And where
And
would
it's just
you
not physiological. And if they're isolated, as you say, is that physiological? Is if you take iron gluconate, for instance, ferrous gluconate, are there actually any sources out in nature that mimic that, or are we trying to mimic something that doesn't exist?
Right. Like,
Yeah,
when would you sit
absolutely.
down to any piece of food that only had manganese in it? You wouldn't.
Exactly. No.
So I think that's part of the problem, you know, is that we're just we're not absorbing because the body's like, what the hell is that? You know?
Yeah. There's
But
another thing to this, and that is the speed of absorption. So when you eat some food that, let's say, has manganese in it, it's in a chelated form, and you've got hours, well, at least 90 minutes to absorb that from, you know, the mouth through to the end of the small intestine. But when you take a supplement of manganese, you get this peak, a peak release of it, which is not physiological at all. And that the body might say, "Oh, wow, that's a bit loud. Can you turn down the volume and just play it for longer?" And that's where slow release supplements, so chelated supplements, tend to that usually have a great absorption. However, if you've got a completely unhelpful gut, then sometimes the ionic forms do the job better. So those ionic forms can be absorbed in the esophagus and the gut and the stomach. And they bypass the checks and balances in the gut. Now, that's a good thing and a bad thing. For instance, if it's ionic copper, you're going to get much higher absorption from tap water, say, because of its ionic form, compared to a copper supplement, which might be, you know, an amino acid chelate. So sometimes the checks and balances are helpful. Sometimes not having them is helpful, like in colloidal minerals, for instance. So colloidal minerals are absorbed from the upper gut. They don't get to the small gut. So that's why you might see a lot of slow release minerals. Iron's an example of this as well. If you can find slow release versions of the trace elements, you probably have more luck, and it's not such a shock to the mid gut when they come through.
When I was having major, major, major gut issues, I was doing a lot of like implants, you know, like rectal implants of different nutrients, because I felt like I seemed to absorb, or I could notice a difference more. Like if I did a wheatgrass implant, or I put like acerola in the wheatgrass and lactobacillus, or
Yeah.
Esplardy,
They're talking about
Saccharomyces.
retention enema. Is that what you mean? Yeah.
And everything. I mean, I started to recommend it because my husband, who's a chiropractor, was wor working with we were working with children in the spectrum and with spinal cord injuries and all sorts. And a lot of them, we would just stick stuff in their G tubes, but some of them that didn't have G tubes, they had to have we try to get food down them, and they just are so picky
Yeah,
that they wouldn't eat
yeah,
anything. So we started
yeah,
saying, take a nasal bulb, a nasal syringe, and we
yeah.
would just mix colostrum and acerola and like all sorts of things in it and put it with some water. And then the parent would administer it rectally. Amazing, like amazing. Like we would just experiment with stuff like that and find that it was effective. So something was happening at the rectum like that,
Yeah.
absorption.
I know it's hard, isn't it, when you need a cooperative child or one that has, a decent swallowing reflex. Just as a side of that, one of the things I found, because for several years, all I saw was children with autism and developmental delays and behavioral disorders. One of the things about children with low zinc levels is that their taste and smell is quite altered. Everything smells and tastes weird. For instance, they don't get the aroma of food. This is why they don't like vegetables, because if you take away the aroma of a vegetable, it's just really cardboard. So they tend to go for sweet, salty, sour, and bitter. They'll pick one or two of those, and if you can have the food in that format, they'll tend to go for it. Until you bring the zinc level up, when that all that nonsense stops, their olfaction works better, the taste works better, and then suddenly they'll look at your plate and go, oh, can I try yours, mummy? Yours looks good. And when you get them to that point, then your supplementation orally is a lot easier. But until that, they
Interesting.
can be very, very fussy.
We were trying to
And
move the, we were trying to remediate the gut biome. I thought that that's kind of where the pickiness was coming from, that, their microbiomes were just not diverse at all. And so we were trying to give them, fermented cabbage juice and coconut kefir water and stuff like that. And it helped some, but it was the crapshoot, really.
I was thinking that can't remember somewhere. I'll have to look it up, but I thought that kombucha had glucuronic acid in it.
Really?
It's one of the I'll double check that, but yeah, I was
I don't recommend. I used to teach. I used to work for Donna Gates, who wrote The Body Ecology Diet, and she used to help children, with remediating their guts and things. And then it turned into a diet for adults. And I was her raw chef. I would demonstrate how to make cultured vegetables and cultured everything, fermented everything. And then I stopped doing it because I got into this hormone space and started to notice that so many women were having histamine reactions to the ferments. And so I would microdose them with little eyedroppers of the juice, and slowly over time, some women would adapt and be fine with it. Most women didn't have they didn't have the desire to continue to do the
That's the
microdosing.
irony of it, is that the plantarum, Lactobacillus plantarum level of your ferment isn't high enough to deal with the histamine content of the juice. So if you pre-treat them with rhamnosus and plantarum, they can often have the ferment. But then what the whole point of the ferment is to improve their microbiome. So it's a bit of a
That's interesting because
catch 22 there. But the people, worst microbiomes I ever saw were people on the GAPS diet.
that's
And
interesting.
if people are going to do that, they should do a microbiome beforehand to know what their issues are, because killing off
They got
wayward
worse
bacteria,
on the GAPS diet, you mean?
well, they didn't have pre-existing ones, so they had come to me because they'd been on the GAPS diet for several years and not feeling any better,
Oh, I see.
and they said, oh, I think there might be something wrong with your microbiome, and it wasn't fixed on the GAPS diet because you didn't know what your starting point was.
Interesting.
So you could adjust your ferments depending on what was actually low.
I mean, I tended to have quite high histamine issues, but I would make my own and I would put loads of herbs in them, and just stick like tons of herbs because those herbs are filled with plantarum, right? And so, but I never had issues like that ever with histamine and my, so I don't know what it is. It's so
Oh,
different.
some people genetically are more prone to histamine issues. It's another one of those. It's such a problem that there's lots of ways to deal with it. It's got multiple intersections of where you can
That's
deal
a
with histamine.
podcast on its own because that is a huge
Probably.
problem. I do have
Oh,
histamine
absolutely.
issues, but not from ferments. I have them from the strangest things like collagen. And yeah, like it's that is a that we speak about that every day in our group because women are just a loss. I drink a lot of nettles because I think it helps with my histamine issues, but anyway, well, again, I mean, honestly, I could just pick a subject and we could just go down the rabbit hole. It's awesome.
Yes, there's a
I've
lot of
written
rabbit
all
holes
of these possible ideas for other shows. If you ever
now.
just want to be,
You're going to
how
keep me
about we
busy for
just
that
do
the next
one a
decade.
month? How about one a
Oh,
month?
okay. Yeah, sure. Okay.
You'll be my special
Yeah, pick the
guest.
subject. Yeah. Well, look, I'm not having a go at any of the previous speakers or anything, but my whole, I mean, having a medical degree and having an interest in biochemistry, I was taught that subject. I wasn't, didn't come from another Bachelor of Arts, for instance, in fine arts, and trying to talk about a subject that I wasn't trained in. So, and the other thing I have, I think, as an advantage is I'm still treating patients. I'm not sitting around writing textbooks that are out of date the nanosecond you print them. I am still evolving and writing those things as I go because the landscape is not fixed. It's being bulldozed and rebuilt and weathered and eroded and built up. It's constantly changing. So when I think you get better information from people who are at that cutting edge of dealing treating patients. You can make all these claims you like, but at the end of the day, the therapeutics of it allows you to test your hypotheses a lot better because you have the a legal authority to, and the professional infrastructure for it. So, yeah.
Well, I'm grateful for that. I'll tell you that. And so I'm so glad that you joined me again after our audio issues were fixed. And we got to talk about Beta G's new album. I'm going to
Yeah.
have to explain that to
Becky G.
everyone.
Rebecca Gomez. She's a
Well,
Latino singer. She lives in Venice Beach. So it's just down the road from you.
perfect. Yes, I'm so excited about that book. Thank you so much. And
I knew that would make your day.
okay. I talked to a few people who absolutely were right with him on every single moment of that episode. I struggled, and you could probably tell, although I edited some of it out, where I was just like, wait a minute, what? So it's definitely complex. I mean, mineral balancing and hair tissue mineral analysis is extremely complicated. And I'm so glad he spoke on iron because it's just not that easy, friends. It's not just easy as easy as taking an iron supplement. Or an iodine supplement, or whatever. Like the idea is to really try to get these things through your nutrient dense diets. And yeah, anyway, you know my spiel on that. Again, please join my Substack. It's going really well, and I'm starting to really funnel a lot of my information through there, including my podcasts, which are now living on my Substack because Substack hosts them now. So if you've been using a particular RSS feed link to listen to my podcast and it's not working anymore, that's why. It's because it's no longer on a cast. And so you have to, if you're having issues with it, go to Substack and get the link from there. You can still listen to it on all the podcast platforms. It hasn't gone anywhere, and on healthygutgirl.com. What else? Onas is having a sale right now. 20% off. Spring 20 is the coupon. Spring 20. 20% off your entire order. And a lot of these prices have already come down since the last time we had a price increase, and they have returned back to the old prices again. So not only are you getting the old prices, but you're also getting 20% off. So that's awesome. That's going to happen up until the 23rd of March. And I think that's everything. Please check out the show notes, because that's where you're going to find Dr. Tabrizian. Thanks for joining us. Yeah.